Now it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Donald Trump's comments about banning Muslims from the United States have been denounced across the political spectrum.
And as Trump's popularity remains high among Republican primary voters, Republicans are starting to worry not only about his effect on the presidential race, but on congressional races as well.
Meanwhile, increased concerns over national security could still give Republicans a boost in both state and national elections. Harry Enten is back with us now, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Trump has made headlines, and this time he drew heavy criticism for his plan to ban Muslims from entering the United States. How did that plan go over both in this country and abroad?
Well, I mean, in this country, he, as you said, it drew widespread criticism from both his rivals, from Democrats, from foreign policy people who weren't necessarily involved in the campaign. But what's most interesting about his words were they were also critiqued by leaders abroad. We saw Boris Johnson, the mayor of London. We saw Benjamin Netanyahu, who's going to still meet with Trump within the next few months. But he also said that's not what we believe in Israel. So this was the type of moment where you said, wow, this isn't just about politics anymore, not just about the election, but about policy, about foreign policy, and about national security. There are a lot of people within the national security world who believe that these types of comments are very, very dangerous for the U.S. view among Muslims abroad.
He was defended in some very specific quarters. I saw a quote by Laura Ingraham, conservative talk personality, who said, anyone who thinks that Donald Trump's comments are not hitting a base with some sectors of the American population, I'm paraphrasing, but they're out of touch, essentially. What do you make of remarks like that?
Sure. So we should differentiate between what leaders are saying and what voters actually feel. And, for example, we know that Republican voters do not have very warm feelings towards Islam. We know that from the polling. We also know that from the polling that there are a lot of Republicans, not the majority of Republicans, depending on which poll you look at, who are perfectly fine with this type of ban. So that, of course, is important, but it should also be pointed out that leaders are saying opposite things to what the voters are saying. So maybe Trump is tapping into something that all of these leaders, Republican leaders, foreign policy leaders, don't quite understand. And I think that's part of the thing that Trump has been doing throughout this campaign, is tapping into sentiments among voters that most leaders would never want to touch, but Trump is willing to touch them, and that's why he is getting the poll numbers that he's getting.
Well, you wrote a piece recently about how that renewed focus on terrorism that we've seen in the wake of terrorists and the San Bernardino shootings, how that's going to impact the presidential election. What did you find?
Well, what's very interesting is if you look at sort of the we can, you know, provide a list of issues to voters and ask, who do you trust more on this, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party? And when it comes to terrorism, this is one of the issues in which Republicans do very, very well. More voters trust Republicans than Democrats. And we know throughout history, you can go back all the way back to 1956, when voters trust a particular party more on an issue, and let's say that issue is very important, it increases the chance that that party is going to win in the general election. So right now, you know, we're still 11 months out from the general election, but if terrorism remains at the forefront, it's probably good news for the Republican Party. With that said, Donald Trump is probably not good news for the Republican Party in the general election, as we can see with his favorable ratings so far down in the toilet among the general electorate at large.
Now, in terms of bringing Trump down, this is something, it seems like no matter what he says, it's hard to get a handle on anything that will really impact his ratings, although he has nudged down a bit. But do you think that this sort of remark, and it's been criticized by world leaders and here in this country by his fellow Republicans, is this the sort of thing that could begin to kind of nudge out a weakness?
Well, you know, Trump has made so many comments throughout this campaign that people like myself, analysts, have said, oh, that has to be the one that knocks him down. And then a poll comes out a week later, and he's actually a point or two up. So I'm very hesitant to say any particular comment that Donald Trump makes is going to drive his numbers down. But what we do know in primaries throughout history, you know, going back to 1980, is that when you don't have the elite within the party with you, say the establishment, the elected officials, when they're not with you, it's very difficult to win a nomination. And the polling at this point for, say, Iowa or New Hampshire isn't all that predictive to what's going to actually be the case. What's more predictive is the endorsements. Trump doesn't have any. Now, maybe Trump is different than everybody else who's run before. He's certainly different in a lot of ways. But if that pattern holds of establishment support and having the endorsements of party leaders being important, then Trump is eventually going to flame out, but we'll have to see on that.
Now, another issue coming out of the San Bernardino shooting is of course, guns. And early on, Hillary Clinton had distinguished herself as being in favor of stricter gun laws. Now, there have been a fair amount of mass shootings since then, but are these events, these shootings, are they going to get people more invested in her platform?
Well, I think, you know, among Democrats, this is, you know, she's always been trying to find a way to make not be run to the left, you know, of somebody running to the left of her. So in 2008, you know, Barack Obama was able to get to her left on the Iraq War, and that was probably what cost her the primary. This year, we had Bernie Sanders, who was coming up from behind, was starting to take a lead in New Hampshire, was coming pretty close in Iowa. And then all of a sudden, he's kind of leveled out. And one of the reasons that he has leveled out, if you look at the polls, Democrats don't care if he's a socialist. They actually agree with a number of the issues that are associated with democratic socialism. But what they do disagree with Sanders on significantly is gun control, is gun safety. And Clinton has been able to tap into that. And events like San Bernardino only help solidify her hold on the Democratic nomination. She's ahead in Iowa right now. She's probably even with Sanders in New Hampshire, which isn't too surprising because he's from next door, Vermont. But then in a state like South Carolina with a lot of African-American voters, she's well ahead. So I think that gun control has been very helpful to her to making sure that she's got the Democratic nomination in hand.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the latest in national politics.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you think Donald Trump's comments will affect the 2016 elections, if at all? Are threats from the Islamic State affecting what you think of as national priorities, as the key voting issues? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, about the latest in national politics, including Donald Trump, congressional elections, and an impending, maybe, government shutdown by the end of the week.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How big a role is the threat of terrorism going to play in who you support in the primaries and ultimately in the election? And do you think Congress will be able to govern without a shutdown under Paul Ryan's new leadership? Call 800-642-1234 or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Harry, we were talking about Hillary Clinton, the Republican field there. But how much of all of this is going to come down to a referendum on how President Obama has handled the threat of terrorism if this continues to be something that's at the top of everybody's list come November?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a small sample size going back to campaigns in which the incumbent president doesn't run for reelection and polling. But what we do know from those is that his approval rating is correlated to how well the incumbent party's candidate does. And we sort of set a line right at about 48 to 50%. That is, if the incumbent president is polling below that, then his party tends to do worse than we otherwise would expect. And if he's polling above that, then they do better than we would expect. And right now, Obama's approval rating is around 45, 46%. So he is probably not helping Hillary Clinton if she goes on to win the nomination. And terrorism is an issue in which he polls particularly poorly. Handling of ISIS is an issue on which he also performs particularly poorly. And Americans are not buying what he's selling right now. He is not helpful to Hillary Clinton. Whether or not he's so hurtful that she ends up losing because of that, we can't say. But we do know that his handling of this issue is not well-liked by the American people, and Hillary Clinton's hurt because of it.
He just had that Oval Office address on terrorism, I think it was Sunday night. Did you see any needle bump happening then? I mean, obviously that was intended to reassure people and maybe convince those who were less favorably inclined toward him to think, well, maybe he's got this, you know, under control and we're doing okay. Did it do that?
Well, we have, keep in mind, you know, it's only been a few days, but we really haven't seen any movement in the polls. And to be honest, this is the type of thing. Look, people know who President Obama is. He's been in there for, you know, nearly 7 years now. They know whether they like him or they don't like him. His approval rating has maintained a percentage of 45, 46% since the beginning of the year. And the people's choices are locked in. Their feelings on him are locked in. And I'm not really quite sure there's very much he can do outside of a major economic boom in this country. And while the economy is not doing as poorly as it was when he entered office, I think that a lot of American voters don't feel that it's doing particularly well either. And that is not helpful to Hillary Clinton come next year.
We're going to move over to Congress now. Now, we were talking a little bit about the issue of guns in the wake of these mass shootings, and the issue has risen to the top about the gun sales to people on the country's no-fly list. Do you think there could be any legislation there around that issue?
Well, this is a very interesting thing because Republicans normally have been in favor of these no-fly lists and, you know, being very protective of the country. If you're on that no-fly list, they, you know, they're usually more hawkish. But on this particular issue, they do not want people who are on that no-fly list to be banned from purchasing guns. And the reason for that is that a lot of people end up on this no-fly list who shouldn't be there. I believe Ted Kennedy was on the no-fly list when he was a senator back in the day. There are a lot of mistakes that are on there. So to me, it's very unlikely that you'll be see a legislation whereby people who are on that no-fly list are going to be banned from purchasing guns, though it's kind of an interesting thing, which I think points out that these lists are far from perfect, and maybe that's something that this country needs to work on.
I guess that's a sidelight, but how would Ted Kennedy get on the no-fly list?
I think he had some name, there was something, you know, something with the programming. This is just one of those ridiculous things that proves that the government sometimes is not as good at collecting information as we think it is. And it's something that perhaps that we should work on, that might be a piece of legislation we might come out whereby we just become better at collecting data both on terrorism and on crime in general. And I think that that's one of the things that we've certainly seen over the last few months with these police shootings is that the United States government does not keep a very good kind of calculation on how much crime is going on, how dangerous people are. We're pretty good, but we're far from perfect.
Well, so also in Congress, the Senate overwhelmingly passed a rewrite of No Child Left Behind, sending it on to President Obama's desk, and he says he's going to sign it tomorrow. So what are the main changes that we'll see from that rewrite?
Yeah, we're basically going to see that a lot of the power is going to be shifted back to the states, that there's going to be less testing that's going to be mandated by the federal government for students who are in high school. And this is something that, both, as you said, it's an overwhelming majority of both parties want. And in fact, the votes that were against it were from people who thought that not enough power was going back to the states. And I think that this is, you know, as we talk about Jeb Bush and maybe why his campaign isn't doing particularly well, I think part of it is obviously that Jeb Bush is not that good of a candidate, but it's also because people remember George W. Bush. And this was one of the things that was so big for his presidency, and to see it just kind of people bashing it. I think that that was one of the things that Jeb Bush kind of underestimated was how many people remember George W. Bush's presidency and how many people really would prefer not to go back to another Bush being in the White House.
So then fair to say that people on both sides of the aisle see No Child Left Behind as is more or less a failure?
I think that they would say that it is certainly not a success. I think failure is sometimes a strong word, but I would say that they certainly don't see it as a success. And I think that the idea of the government sort of mandating, the federal government mandating certain qualifications and certain rules being put into place is something that, especially in the Republican Party these days, voters and Republican elected officials don't want any part of.
All right. Well, so for our last 30 seconds, government shutdown again looming. Is it going to happen?
I think that it probably won't. They're talking about CRs, continuing resolutions. But, you know, this is a government that has proven time and time again that they don't necessarily know what they're going to do. So it wouldn't shock me, but I would bet heavily against it right now.
Harry, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the latest in national politics. We talked about Donald Trump, Congress, and the probably not congressional shutdown.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll look at how Senate candidates Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold are approaching the issue of national security on the campaign trail.
First, far from the political conversation over who should or shouldn't come to the United States, are the organizations hard at work resettling refugees in communities around the country.
Newly arrived refugees may need help with everything from learning English to finding a job and maybe preparing for a first winter.
World Relief Fox Valley is one of the groups dedicated to helping refugees make that transition to Wisconsin from places like the Democratic Republic of Congo and Iraq. Here with us now to talk about the work they do is Tammy McLaughlin. She's office director for World Relief Fox Valley. Tammy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for this opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Can you tell us first about some of the challenges that recent refugees face when they settle in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, you made a great introduction. First and foremost, I think for most of them is just the cold weather. So many of them are coming from warm climates. So they hear about winter and snow and haven't seen either, really. So that's always something that we laugh at, but it really is kind of a fear for them. And then just transitioning to a new culture, employment, different types of housing than they've ever been used to. Almost everything that they experience feels new and different to them.
Well, I feel culture shock sometimes just going to another state in the United States, much less another country, much less actually living there. What are some of the biggest elements of culture shock that people might experience when they come as a refugee from another country to live in Wisconsin?
I think just in, you know, the American culture in general is a very individualized nuclear family type culture, and they come from communities where your family includes aunts, uncles, grandparents, neighbors, everybody, you know, who surround you. So I think that's something big and something that that helps us get other people involved, because community is so important to the support and the onboarding and the acclimation of these people. So community is huge. Language is definitely can be an obstacle, because most of them come, if they speak some English, it's not a lot of English. So learning a completely new language, and with language also comes different types of communication skills in general. So those are two very big issues that they arrive with, and that we try and help with community support to get them through those obstacles.
Well, when you're working with a refugee and they first arrive, maybe they and their family first arrive in the Fox Valley, what's job one? What are some of the first things that you and your organization do to help them make that difficult transition?
Our first 30 days are extremely busy with them. We've secured their apartment and have them furnished when they get here, but it's just, you know, teaching all the basics of the apartments, smoke detectors, plumbing. Some of them haven't experienced before, locking doors and windows, air conditioning, heating, that type of thing. So those are very basics. In the first, what we call the next day visit, we walk them through all of those basic elements of their housing. We also register them in lots of things for benefits, for school, for the children, for English classes, for the adults. We do orientations for them. Health orientations are a big thing. Cultural orientations. Start getting them prepared for employment. So we do employment type orientations. So register them for Social Security. So many registrations, applications, orientations. Like I said, they're very, very busy those first 30 days, because that's when we do the majority of the work with them and those types of things. And then after that, we do more life skills training, things that we can take a little more time, that aren't as urgent, but are still very important.
We're talking to Tammy McLaughlin from World Relief Fox Valley about the work that the organization does with newly arrived refugees here in Wisconsin. And Tammy, there have been questions lately, especially after the Paris terror attacks, about who we should take as refugees, whether we should take them in. I wanted to ask what motivates you and World Relief Fox Valley to bring in refugees, to help them arrive here. Why is this important to be involved in for you?
Well, first and foremost, they come from such chaotic and traumatic backgrounds, and they are survivors, and they inspire us actually when we work with them, because they come with such hope and a future before them that they've never had, and to help people develop that and to see it come true is really encouraging and inspiring for us. We also are not concerned about any security issues that they might bring with them. We are very comfortable and confident in what the government has established as a security process for them. It takes 18 to 24 months. We had a client arrive 2 weeks ago who said it took him 3 years to get through the process. So it's very thorough. It includes interviews, health screenings, background checks, more background checks. It includes the Department of State, Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and other agencies and bureaus. So by the time we get here, we know who they are and we know where they're from. And we know sometimes what they've come from and the experiences they've had. Maybe not specific instances, but again, to be a refugee, you have had to have the fear of persecution. If you have stayed in your homeland, there's a very likely chance you would have been killed. And many of our clients come to us having lost family members. So when these people arrive, they're vulnerable. They've been through a lot. They're not vulnerable doesn't mean weak or doesn't mean victims, but they've been through so much. And my and my staff and our community partners just treasure this opportunity again to show them a new hope and a new future.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. These aren't just random people coming to this country. These are people who've been through, as you say, the threat of persecution. You said a chaotic experience, maybe trauma. Is there any kind of extra help beyond what you would think of with moving to a foreign country, with the language, the jobs, things like that? Are there services out there to help refugees recover from maybe trauma, maybe even kids recovering from trauma?
And absolutely, and that's where we really depend on our community partners. We sit on roundtable discussions once a month with our community partners, both in Oshkosh and Appleton, which is where we're resettling refugees. And these partners include school system, health providers, fire and police departments, sometimes city representatives, churches, pastors sometimes attend. And we talk about some of the gaps that maybe need to be filled and need to be covered to provide better services for our clients. And sometimes mental health might be an issue, or bus system might be an issue. Maybe they're not grasping that concept well. So, you know, there's different things at different points for different people. And that, again, is where we really depend on our partners to work through those situations and provide the best resettlement experience that we can.
Getting back to the national conversation about Syrian refugees in particular, but the concerns about safety, about who we should take in, is that conversation affecting the work you do either by maybe making local community members less willing to be involved, or maybe affecting the reaction of the refugees themselves? Or is this getting to them as well?
We haven't come out and said to them, oh, have you been watching the news? Mm-hmm. What do you think? You know, our conversations are more, how are you doing? Is everything okay? Is there anything you're afraid of or anything you feel unsure of? And they seem to be doing very well for the most part. And, you know, most of them have community. We resettle in communities. So we have a large community of Congolese, a large community of Iraqis, a large community of Burmese. And they really, really support each other well within their own community also. So that certainly is a positive and a benefit for them. With regard to our community or the community at large, we feel very well supported. We've had a few calls and we expected that. But most people, you know, not necessarily change their mind, but if you can have conversations with them and hopefully, encourage them to get more knowledge and education. And there's a lot of that out there. And sometimes we like to form opinions just by what we see or hear on TV without really delving into all the facts and all the, again, the background checks and the history behind how this program works. So we really encourage people to take some time before they make final judgments and final decisions about whether to support this or not.
I wanted to focus in on kids. I understand at least some of the refugees coming over are children. What is involved in helping them make the transition into the American educational system?
Well, we have great community supports in both school systems. Oshkosh and Appleton school system are very involved and normally, you know, have orientations before they even get to school, personal orientations with the students and with the parents, because, again, the education process is so much different in the United States. Often they're in their own classes to start with, or they're with other children who need enhanced English lessons. So, you know, they oftentimes, the children learn English and adapt quicker than the adults do. So sometimes they're more of an adult role model in terms of the languages and some of the culture than the parents are. There's a role reversal there. So they're very instrumental and very beneficial to their families when children do arrive. And of course, we love, you know, we love having children. And again, just because we know they bring so much potential and have such a bright future than they would have had where they were at.
If I can end on a lighter note, Tammy, what kind of things do you hear from the refugees you work with about Wisconsin? What do they make of this place that we maybe take for granted?
Again, the cold. They really have a hard time getting over the cold. Other than that, I think they feel very welcomed. They feel well received. This is home. They don't know really anything different for the United States, so they can't compare it to anything. And I think sometimes that's a benefit, right? So they seem to be doing very well. And again, it's because of the community that supports us and them. And we just really appreciate all of that and everything that everybody's been doing.
Tammy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate your time.
That's Tammy McLaughlin. She's Office Director for World Relief Fox Valley, a Wisconsin-based organization that helps resettle refugees here in the state.